It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
When we say the word vacation, you might picture a white sand beach in Florida, or maybe a trip to an amusement park, or even Yellowstone with your family. However, guidebook author and public television host Rick Steves thinks you should travel as an opportunity to get out of your comfort zone.
Steves has written 50 books on what to do, see, and eat in countries all over the world, but he considers his latest book, Travel as a Political Act, How to Leave Your Baggage Behind, his most valuable and important text for travelers.
Steves believes that we can learn more about America by observing other countries. Travel might seem scary given tensions around the world, but Steve says what we gain from taking that risk far outweighs the risk itself.
Steve's recently joined Audrey Nowakowski by phone from his home in Seattle and started by recalling his first experiences abroad.
I didn't want to go to Europe when my parents dragged me to Europe when I was a little teeny bopper. My dad imported pianos from Germany, and he came home one day and he said, "Son, we're going to Europe to see the piano factories." And I thought, "Dad, that's a stupid idea." Then I got over there, and it occurred to me right after day two, I thought, "Oh, this is not that bad. You know, there's different candy, different soda pop, statuesque women with hairy armpits in Germany." It was just a wondrous world for this little 14-year-old kid. And then a couple years later, I was with my parents at the train station in Copenhagen on the way up to see relatives in Norway. And I'll never forget seeing these kids a couple years older than me with rucksacks and year-rail passes, and the world was their playground, and they had no parents. And I looked at my parents, and I thought, I don't need you guys for this. Europe can be my playground, too. I'm going back to Europe every year for the rest of my life, and I have. For the first few years, I was making all sorts of mistakes, and then I realized I was learning from my mistakes. And over the years, I found, you know, of course, you got to learn how to pack light and catch the train and find a good hotel. But what's really important is to learn how to get out of your comfort zone and have a broadening experience and come home with what I think is the greatest souvenir, and that's that broader perspective. So, you know, with Travel as a Political Act, the new edition of my book, I'm really challenging Americans to go beyond Orlando and get out of their comfort zone. There's nothing risky about it. There's nothing particularly expensive about it. It's just transformative, and it's more important than ever that Americans who are curious get out there and get to know the world.
Right. And do you think we as Americans should ultimately rethink that concept of, quote, vacation? You know, moving away from, you mentioned there's that hedonistic sense of you and vacation
right. That,
you know, we only take those because we feel it's, quote, worthwhile to spend our money and our time off in that way. But you mentioned travel should be transformative, not necessarily like, oh, I'm escaping somewhere.
Well, no, I don't think we need to get away from the notion of vacation. That's a beautiful part of travel. I just went to the Yucatan with my family, and we laid on the beach and did all the first world things in a third world environment. But we hired a local guide and went into the jungle and got to know people in Mayan communities. And we had that rich and real experience. In our travels, ironically, we can leave home and just exacerbate the difference between us and them if we just stay on golf courses and stay in resorts. Or we can connect more closely with the other 96% of humanity by getting out of our comfort zone and talking to real people. What carbonates your travel experience is to talk with real people, not the lady who meets you at the airport and puts a lei around your neck when you arrive and says aloha, but real people who aren't in the tourist industry. You know, when you're in Ireland, go to a pub, and in a pub where there's not tourists, and don't sit at a table where they leave you alone, but sit at the bar where people know you want to talk. When you're in Spain, go out and stroll in the evening on the paseo with the locals. You know, and when you're in Turkey, go to a hookah bar and ask a local person to teach you how to suck on one of those big hubbly bubblies and learn how to play backgammon. There are so many great ways that you can make that experience more vivid. When I'm working on a tour or writing one of our guidebooks or making a TV show, if I'm not having my American travelers connect with real people, I'm not doing my job. That's what distinguishes a good trip.
In a way, we are a small representation of our country when we go somewhere else. And you mentioned that America is often seen as an empire, as our brand overseas. And, you know, we have the Secretary of State doing official diplomatic duties while traveling, but that's only one type of ambassador. What do you think is a good way that we can be better civil ambassadors to disprove the America First narrative that's so prevalent right now while we're traveling?
Right. Well, when we travel, we are ambassadors, and a lot of Americans travel and they wear a Canadian flag because they're afraid to be seen as an American. First of all, that's kind of silly. I mean, there's no negative to be seen as an American. People are sophisticated enough to know that different societies can vote for people who are regrettable to be in their executive branch. I mean, Italy had Berlusconi, and a lot of people are kind of reluctant to travel now because they're wondering, what are they going to think about when we've got President Trump? Go travel and talk to people. The cool thing about traveling is we humanize each other. You go to people who are supposed to be our enemies. I was just in Iran. I was just in Palestine. I was just in Cuba. And you talk to people, and it makes it tougher for their propaganda to demonize us. And then when we come home, it makes it tougher for our propaganda to demonize them. And that's just a beautiful thing. We are connectors that way. And the more we travel, the safer this world's going to become. The irony is the people who are most frightened in our society are the people buried deep in the middle of it without passports, whose worldview is shaped by watching commercial TV news. If people can just realize that fear is for people who don't get out very much, the flip side of fear is understanding. And there's a lot of ways to gain understanding, but one of the beautiful ways to gain understanding is to travel.
Right. One big point you make is that terrorism is overrated, that we should get beyond the fear, as you mentioned, get beyond our, our outside doors.
Yeah. Terrorism is certainly overrated. I mean, it's a horrible thing, but I don't want to overreact to it and make a little terrorist bomb a big terrorist bomb. And Europe's really good at not being terrorized by the terrorists. And we are really bad at not being terrorized by the terrorists. Mm-hmm. We richly reward terrorists by overreacting, and our commercial news play with all the hysteria plays right into that. Look at it statistically. Don't confuse fear and risk. It's okay to be afraid. That's what these things are designed to do. But don't think that is equated to risk. Europe has 400 million people. If one person or five people or 10 people are killed tomorrow, it doesn't make it any more dangerous than Las Vegas is dangerous right now because of what recently happened there. I've spent a third of my adult life living out of a carry-on the airplane-sized suitcase overseas, talking with people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And my major takeaway is this world is filled with joy and love and beautiful people, and it's just a great opportunity to get to know the family when you get out there and travel.
You mentioned in your book several places in Europe and across the globe that deal with the dualism of living post-conflict, of two sides that once fought against each other, you know, moving on to their new reality. How do you balance taking in both sides and reflecting on your experience for either like a written post or a produced piece, and making people outside of these countries who are just getting a glimpse, not understanding the deep-seated conflict that perhaps laid before them? How do you encourage people to expand that view and to see both sides? Because we often, as you mentioned, see an over-exemplified thing on our side, on the news end.
I love to go to conflicted areas, not dangerous areas, but areas where there is complications that are being sorted out over time, like Ireland or the Holy Land or, former Soviet Union, and talk to people. Go to St. Petersburg and find out why people support Putin. I mean, Putin has had 80% approval rating for years, and it's hard to imagine why that would be from our point of view. But when you go to Russia, you realize, hey, they've got stability, they can travel, and their economy is reasonably good compared to as it has been in past times. And in relative terms, it's good times in Russia right now. You go to the Holy Land and you realize how one-sided our news coverage is of the Israeli-Palestinian struggle. And you go there and you talk to Israelis and you gain an empathy and a sympathy for their concerns and their needs. And then you cross the wall and you go to the West Bank and you talk to Palestinians and you gain an empathy for their point of view. It's not an easy right or wrong situation, but there's good people on both sides of that wall. And an unintended consequence of that wall, by the way, is it keeps the younger generations on both sides from talking to each other. And I think that's a tragic thing. Then you go to Ireland and you realize they've actually succeeded in their sectarian challenges. And now the troubles are over in Ireland. And that was not easy to do, but they worked at it. And they had a concerted effort of getting the younger generation to go to summer camp together and learn to play and dance together. And today, the new generation of Irish Catholics and Protestants are no longer shooting each other. And that's a huge triumph, and it should be an inspiration for other conflicted regions.
Some conflicted regions or experiences can encourage people to move out of their own country. And several times in your book, you mention how, you know, you love America more than the places you travel, even though, you know, you may love these experiences. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts about expatriatism?
Oh, when people leave America? Well, everybody has the right to leave America if they want. I've got a lot of friends that I know that are glad that they have two passports and whatever, however they've been able to finagle dual citizenship. And they kind of jokingly say, you know, we're ready to go back to the Netherlands or Germany or France or Canada if we need to. I'm an American through and through. I mean, I love going to Europe, and I do that every year. I spend 4 months a year in Europe for the last 30 years. But the happiest day of the year for me is when I come home. As I sit here in my office, I'm looking up the street at my old junior high school, and I haven't ventured very far that way. I'm so thankful that I live in the United States, and I'm very committed to the democracy and the fabric of our communities. And I have a rather European point of view that people can get together and make things better collectively, you know, by paying taxes and having a government that represents the people. That's a European sensibility. I've spent decades trying to figure out the difference between Europe and the United States because it's an interesting case study. And in both sides of the Atlantic, we're affluent, democratic, pluralistic, predominantly Christian countries, really passionate about government by, for, and of the people. But I've realized that in the United States, we're government by, for, and of the people via the corporations that we own. It's not a judgmental statement. It's just pretty clear. We want our government simply to clear the way so our corporations can prosper, and then we can all prosper along with it. In Europe, it's different. It's government by, for, and of the people in spite of the interests of their corporations. So you'll find laws in Europe that are not good for business in the short term, but they're good for society in the long term, whereas you'd find the flip-flop of that here in the United States. Again, it's not right or wrong. I'm glad I'm running my business here in the United States, but it's really instructive and challenging and stimulating for me to get out of my bubble and talk to smart people who see things differently, and then we can compare notes, and I think we can be smarter in our society. You know, this way I've been able to get tuned into a lot of interesting issues that I'm passionate about, affordable housing, third world debt, drug policy reform, all sorts of fascinating issues that when you go overseas, you get to talk to people and you come home and you can get involved and make a difference.
A lot of these challenges can encourage people to go volunteer in other countries. But a lot of the time, many people are accused of, you know, being the white savior. And this whole white savior complex is more about having a big emotional experience that validates privilege and not necessarily about justice. So what are your thoughts on that? And what do you think are bad travel courtesies? You know, when you take a group somewhere, what are you telling them to keep in mind?
Well, when I take a group somewhere, and this is the main part of my business, I employ about 150 people here in Seattle, and we take 20,000 Americans to Europe every year on 1,000 different tours. And we encourage our travelers to become temporary locals. That's pretty fundamental. Don't go to Europe and compare things to back home. You know, why can't I have a bottomless cup of coffee? Why is the service so slow? You know, it's fun to be a cultural bumpkin. When I grew up, cheese was orange in the shape of the bread. You go to Europe and cheese is really much more sophisticated than that. And people are evangelical about their cheese in France. Well, I don't need to spend a lot of money and be an aficionado of stinky cheese when I get home. But it is kind of fun to know that in France, every cheese shop is a festival of mold, and these people are just so excited about it. And I happen to really like fancy cheese because of my travels. So we can become what I like to think of as a cultural chameleon, Audrey. When I'm in the United States, a cup of tea makes no sense at all to me. But when I'm in England, a spot of tea is just right. When I'm in Greece, I just love a glass of ouzo as the sun goes down. I've never come home here in Seattle and thought, oh, I feel like a nice glass of ouzo. I don't even like it that much here in this hemisphere. But when I'm in Greece, a glass of ouzo is very nice. So with that cultural chameleon approach, I think we fit better into the culture. People appreciate us better. We learn more. We spend less money. And we have potentially a transformational experience. And with that attitude, when we travel, I think we have a better trip.
What piece of advice would you leave people to pry open their blinders a little bit?
I would say be humble about your ethnocentricity. I was raised thinking the world is a pyramid with the United States on top and everybody trying to get there. And until well into my adulthood, I really believed that if a different government didn't understand it our way, we, because we care and are so smart, would have the right to get in there and try to elect a government for them that that did get it right. And since then, I've been humbled, and I find the world, you know, we have the American dream, and that's my dream and so on. But my Norwegian relatives don't have the American dream. They got the Norwegian dream. And my friends in Sri Lanka have the Sri Lankan dream. And my friends in Bulgaria have the Bulgarian dream. That's not putting our dream down. It's just acknowledging that the world is filled with different dreams. I was raised thinking the work ethic is the work ethic. No, it is a work ethic. My Spanish friends have, they take a siesta and paseo in the evening. They've got the Spanish work ethic. Do they work as hard as us? No. Is that wrong? Of course not. They choose to have a different lifestyle, and I'm just really challenged by that. I absolutely love it, and that's one of the joys of travel is you realize, yeah, I love the world. I'm open-minded, but I'm also, whether I like it or not, I'm ethnocentric. And it is so instructive to go to India and sit down at a restaurant and have somebody sit down next to you and you say, and he says to me, this is just an experience I had. He said, you're an American, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, I want you to know that a third of the people on this planet eat with spoons and fork like you, a third of the people eat with chopsticks, and a third of the people eat with their fingers like I do, and we're all civilized just the same. And I thought, oh, he's got a chip on his shoulder about this. But then I thought about it more, and it's true. I thought less of him because he ate with his fingers. And he was telling me he eats with his fingers knowing he could have a spoon or a fork, but God made his fingers in order to help him nourish himself, and he thinks that's a more elegant way to eat, and that's a beautiful thing.
Well, Rick Steves, I'd like to thank you for giving us some of your insights about traveling as a political act today.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for your interest in that, and happy travels.
Rick Steves is a guidebook author and travel TV host. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about his recent book, Travel as a Political Act, How to Leave Your Baggage Behind.
You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at WUWM.com.